accession number 23329, reel 22.
Younger, reel 22.
As far as I can remember, only one man actually died from the septicemia, but some lost the use of fingers, and although mine was a bad case, and it was months before the wounds healed properly, I was very lucky and suffered no disability. In the middle of one night in the ward, I could hear the wind outside, and I was very pleased to be comfortable and warm in the sick bay. I realized the light was on and there was a stretcher on the floor. On it was a lad I'd known originally at Sagan in Block 40. He'd been brought in from the compound, his hutmates having signaled to a guard that they had a medical emergency. The medical officer seemed to me to be treating this chap in a very strange way. He was slapping his face, first the right side and then the left, and he was intoning, get up, and the man, I'm not mentioning his name, kept moaning, "Oh my Swede, oh my Swede." Swede being his word for a head. I hadn't heard that one before. I guess that the doctor was convinced that he was malingering, but I couldn't help wondering what if he was wrong. But then the patient admitted that it was a try-on, and the doctor told him that he could stay till morning. We jeered him as if we owned the ward, and in a way he was as ill as we were, and yet we ostracized him. We can be very cruel at times. Anyway, he stayed with us all the next morning. He asked if anybody could spare him a fag. Eventually, I gave him two. And when he was leaving to return to the compound, I said, "Don't forget, you owe me two cigarettes, Shorty." "I won't forget," he said. Yeah. The cigarettes came back to me with a note of thanks, in words that were not ungenerous as mine had been. Astronomic ambition. When I came out of the sick bay, I was still pretty shaken and my right arm was useless. But Dick and I enjoyed talking about celebrating our homecoming, and Dick was very rashly promising his father's port and cigars. One day that did come to pass. It was fascinating to hear men talk of their ambitions for when they got home, particularly the food, as I mentioned before. Some saw themselves having the lightest of souffles, and others planning stocks of bully beef. While I'd been away, Dick and Toby had done some work on their bunks and also on mine. They'd nailed the bedboards to cover the lower part of the bunk, and then somehow they'd got hold of some sacking and they fashioned a kind of half hammock, and they'd filled that with pieces of spruce and fir and pine brought in by the wood gatherers from the forest. It was still uncomfortable, for the boards began just under the hip, and it felt as if they were grinding through to the bone. Then over his bunk, Dick had erected a canopy. He had frail uprights, I don't know where he got those from, and he had a rough mesh made of pieces of string and flattened cardboard boxes, and it was designed to steer leaks from the roof away from bunks, or rather, with that in mind, he had pieces of crude guttering suspended by wire and string, and this ran in a crazy sequence, connecting and interconnecting, dripping from one to another. Each drip sounded a different note, and it became a sort of irritating tune. And we did have something rather more musical. We did have a gramophone, but there was only one record, and the more popular side of that was Oh What a Beautiful Morning. That was played continuously, but in the early hours we would hear the German soldiers singing their rounds in the woods, and the music always sounded haunting in the early morning air, and somebody would wake up and say, what have those bastards got to sing about, and then go back to sleep. I didn't have a canopy or guttering, and there wasn't any more material around to make any. And anyway, with my right hand refusing to heal, it was all I could do to lever myself onto the bunk. Every few minutes a large drop of water fell from the roof, and I was sure someone was aiming it, because no matter how I moved my head, the drop always hit me smack between the eyes. The long freeze-up ended on February the 1st while I was still in the sick bay. The compound had become a mud heap again, and on that day 1,000 fortresses flew over the camp to attack Berlin in daylight. Every night around that time, mosquitoes were homing in on the capital. The news was good, the conditions were miserable, but we were beginning to think that it wouldn't be long now. For years, the letters we'd received had ended, it won't be long now. Now we might have believed it, but there were no letters. Heidekrug and Thorn had fallen to the Russians long ago. Now we heard that Sagan was invested, and it was strange to think that all those camps, in each of which we had visualized liberation, had fallen to the Allies. We wondered where the officers who'd been at Stalag-Luft 3 were. They had in fact gone out on a killer of a march, often called the Long March. According to the German radio, RAF officers at Sagan were given the choice of remaining and falling into Russian hands or of marching to the west. Without hesitation they marched, carrying those who were unable to walk without hesitation, they marched away from the terrible Russians. Well, they weren't given that choice by a long way. Before Sagan fell, the Germans put on the last train to leave Sagan itself a box addressed to Dixie Deans at Fallingbostel. And in it were all the fountain pens and cigarette lighters and so on confiscated the day we arrived at Sagan. My fountain pen was handed to me, and I wrote the whole of the first draft of my book, No Flight from the Cage, with that pen. We owed a lot at this time to the various bands and musicians in the camp. Stan Paris and his octet would willingly play in any hut that wanted them. They called their show Soft Lights and Sweet Music, and Stan asked me to do a poster, and somehow I got hold of poster colours, and I painted a glamorous lady in a low-cut gown using a photograph of Rita Hayworth, and around her I had caricatures of Paris, Happy Hale, and some of the other instrumentalists. And all the time I was working in this half light in the barrack, there was that incessant accompaniment, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." The octet played in our hut one evening. They had to play with just a single fat lamp. Fat in a tin with a small tin with a wick, because the lights were out, as they always were when there was an air raid on, and mosquitoes were flying over every night at that time. We could hear the noise of the mosquitoes over the music, and it almost became part of the music. And we thought about the crews who were braving those winter nights to get to Berlin. After the performance, we gave the octet coffee, and then out they went into the dark and the wet and the mud and the rain. We had a room committee which would sometimes arrange a lecture, and entertainment of that kind meant that the bickering stopped, and for a little while people would be much more brotherly. But we'd been living on twice daily sweet soup and about an eighth of a loaf of ersatz bread. The potato ration was also in the soup. We did get German coffee, which was compounded of acorns and charcoal, and didn't taste of anything very much, except one night we made a very enjoyable can of coffee when we had a special issue. The barrack room had a wonderful aroma, and we discovered that the ration had been intended for 10 days and 70 men had actually used the ration of 700, but it was a good brew. Deans was very worried about the 10,000 men in his charge. We were not in the condition of advanced emaciation like the inmates of a concentration camp, but we were suffering badly from malnutrition, and the flesh was disappearing a little every day, and we could still laugh about it, but we were worried about a possible epidemic, and we were also worried about being put to march eastward when we didn't have strength enough to do it. It was interesting if you sat down and watched the life of the camp in a detached fashion. It was like watching a slow motion film. A few hardy types still plodded around the circuit, and each step seemed to be the outcome of a decision almost. Even gestures men made as they talked were stilted. We heard that there was a new Red Cross depot at Lübeck intended to provision camps in northern Germany. We'd even seen photographs of huge white diesel lorries which were to be used. Deans decided that we had to get parcels somehow. Letters brought only promises to supply food when the lorries were available. So he persuaded the commandant to provide a van with a Russian driver and a German officer, and to allow Deans and Alfie Fripp, who was in charge of Red Cross issues, to travel to Lübeck. It was ironic that they took with them bits of Red Cross food, chocolate, cigarettes, soap, which had been taken from damaged parcels, too little even to be worthwhile sharing among the sick, but enough to bribe German officials. They had lunch at a country pub, and then in Lübeck, which they reached late at night, they were accommodated in a German services club and actually slept in a dormitory with enemy soldiers on leave, most of them pretty drunk. Deans and Fripp were very amused by the situation, and though they did appreciate the possibility of an explosion should their identities be discovered. Anyway, in the morning they called on the Red Cross representative, who was a Swede. He told them that there were ample stocks of parcels, but they were in the hands of German shipping agents. Could have, they went to see the shipping agents, that's right, and they were told they could have as many parcels as they could arrange transport for, and they were directed then to the transport officer for the area. Deans wasn't very optimistic because half Lubeck had been devastated by the RAF in March 42, and no German official was likely to have much sympathy for RAF prisoners. The transport officer gave them a categorical no, but to show that he was not being unreasonable, he pointed to a wall map thick with multicoloured pins, which indicated where, and according to the colour, to what degree railway lines were damaged, and there was scarcely a line open in the area. Deans suggested that one, two, or even three trucks could be tacked onto the rear of a passenger train, as passenger traffic was the only one open to at Fellingbostel. That was vetoed. But Alfie Fripp placed a tin of coffee on the table, real coffee, a bar of soap, some chocolate to give him the taste of it, as Deans put it, and he wouldn't agree to three trucks, but they settled for two, and with Deans and Fripp insisting that they should be French rolling stock, which were the largest in use on the German railways. So, with all arrangements made, Deans and Fripp returned to Fellingbostel. On the way, the Russian driver knocked a German dispatch rider off his motorbike, but the escort officer was asleep and didn't wake up, and the Russian drove on, and the dispatch rider shouted curses after them. He didn't seem hurt, and Deans was relieved. They had 200 parcels in the van, so that the sick were able to have a little more than usual. But it wasn't until March the 30th, which was Good Friday as it happened, that the two trucks arrived with 6,000 Canadian parcels, an issue of half a parcel per man. My nerves were strung very tight. Patton had crossed the Rhine on the 21st of March, but we were much more interested in what Montgomery was doing, as Patton was a long way south. Anyway, Montgomery did cross on the 23rd of March, and so we waited, and it seemed an awful long time before he moved any further. Somebody nailed up a picture of Montgomery, and above it was the word wanted, but we had to wait a little while yet. We were increasingly anxious about the Germans putting us out to march us. We were hoping very much that they would clear out and leave us to be liberated. We heard that prisoners near Cassel had already been freed. However, 1,000 Americans marched in to the camp. They'd been footslogging for hundreds of miles. They were put into one of the B compound barracks. Another 800 men came from Tishau. They were former K-Lager men who'd had a very rough time because they were the people who were on the infamous Insterburg, and also were subjected to the run up the road. They too had been marching, and hundreds more were lodged into 11B, which was almost adjacent to us. There were 2,000 men in camps, and still the BBC was just talking about Montgomery's forces in a massive build-up behind a smoke curtain. Rather amused when a German rode through the various compounds on a bicycle. He had a ladder hooked over his arm, and he had a pot of paste and a number of folded sheets. He slapped the bills onto the stone walls of the barracks, and it was a new propaganda line from the Germans, claiming England would find herself isolated against a Soviet Europe and a Soviet Asia from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And it went on that only cooperation between the nations of Europe and the British Empire could safeguard the existence of Europe and her civilization. The type was in blood red, and there were maps showing the areas over which the Germans reckoned the Soviets would extend. We had maps too, and we were defining the Allied advance as it was admitted by the Germans. We didn't dare draw lines that we were getting from the BBC. Dick and I would sit studying the map, and we were almost willing the armies to move, but we kept getting the news starting today, the tactical air force, but it didn't mean that anything important had happened, and we said, blow the tactical air force. Food was very short. We had a speck of jam, crust of bread, a little sugar, and Toby would keep cleaning everything, and it was just the way, I suppose, that almost that he was passing the time. He would do it a dozen times a day, clean out our little food cupboard, and we'd tell him, couldn't he leave it alone? He said, no, I can't. It can't have dirty food cupboards. We'd say, it isn't dirty, you've only just cleaned it. He'd come back, if it wasn't dirty, I wouldn't be doing it. And surprisingly, German workmen came in, and they put a skylight in our barrack, C62. It was the only skylight in the camp, and it was directly over my bunk. And I couldn't help wishing it had been there a few months earlier, so that we could have had a little light through the winter. When the man had finished, Toby stood on his bank, on his bunk, and gazed down at the scene. He was on the top bunk, and he said, so this is humanity. So we told him he'd better inspect the food cupboard. He had more light now to do it. Dick and I were talking about a car journey when we returned to England. If you return, said Toby, if that bloody smokescreen of Montgomery's hasn't suffocated his entire goddamned army, I'll go hobby. A typical Toby remark.